Numbers and Tech Podcast is brought to you in partnership with Speak Studios and Speak Boise. Speak Boise is a community-driven studio space where voices from all walks of life can speak and be heard. You can find them on Instagram and Facebook at Speak Studios, Speak Boise, and at their website, speakstudios.com. Speak Studios, speak and be heard. Numbers and Tech Podcast is also brought to you by Instant Imprints. Promote better with Instant Imprints. Instant Imprints are Boise's visual communications expert and your place for everything you need to promote your business, club, school, or group. As a locally owned business, Instant Imprints specializes in making your organization more visible with custom branded apparel, embroidery, promotional items, print services, and wide format printing for signs, as well as banners and vehicle graphics. Want better ways to get noticed? Visit Instant Imprints at instantimprints.com/Boise or call 208-IMPRINT. That's 208-467-7468. Hi, I'm Melissa, and this is the Numbers and Tech Podcast. Every entrepreneur has a story. Listen to women discuss the financial side of their business, both the challenges and successes. Let's grab life by the bottom line. Hello, this is Melissa Shane with the Numbers and Tech Podcast. My guest this week is Dr. Deanna Snitzer. She's a dentist and owner of Colorado Advanced Dentistry in Lakewood, Colorado. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this all week.
So Deanna and I have known each other for a few years now, and I record this in Boise, Idaho. So when she was coming to visit, I immediately said, you have to come on and share all of your experiences and stories with everyone. So thanks for coming.
I'm happy to be here with you.
So let's just dive in, and why don't you tell everyone a little bit about what your background is and how you became a dentist, because I know that wasn't your first career choice.
No, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and then I went to college at Boston University for my undergraduate degree. And ended up majoring in advertising. So my first life was in marketing. So I started out working in college at the sports marketing department at Boston University. And then I worked for NESN, which is the New England Sports Network, and their sports marketing. And I worked for a magazine in Boston. And I started out in the marketing department. I ended up in the fashion department, which was completely unrelated, but a really fun job. And then I was working as the director of marketing for a small engineering firm in Kansas City. And I was still fairly young. And I was like, all right, now what do I do? Like, I'm, 23, 24. I'm the director of marketing for a company. You don't really get a lot higher than that. And I was bored. And I have a lot of dentists in my family. My dad's a periodontist. My grandfather has like 10 brothers or something, and like 8 of them were dentists. So it was kind of the family business. So it always was something I had thought about. And then I had taken prerequisites for the classes. And, I'd taken extra classes because I was never really sure what I wanted to be when I grew up, but I figured it out a little later. And I said, all right, I'll apply to dental school, and went to UMKC, University of Missouri in Kansas City, and graduated there. And then I worked in a Cherokee hospital for a couple of years, and then moved to Colorado and worked for somebody else for a little while, and then got my place.
Nice, nice. So I always love when people, I think of it as a good thing that maybe you didn't make, maybe your career isn't your first choice. And I think that's okay. I think there's too much pressure put on teenagers or younger people that this is what I have to do for the rest of my life. And no, you can evolve into something else.
Yeah. And I consider it a real benefit for me as a business owner, because most dentists don't know anything about running a business when they graduate from dental school. I mean, you take like one class on practice management, and it's usually kind of like the class nobody goes to, at least it was when we were in school. So, you become HR and you become a manager, and you don't know how to do any of that. You don't know what a profit and loss statement is. You don't know how to do your taxes. You don't know what anything is. You know teeth pretty good when you graduate from dental school, but as a dentist who owns their own business, you have to be a business owner as well as a dentist and wear a lot of different hats. So having a background with a little bit more business orientation for me was so beneficial, because a lot of this, it came more naturally to me. It wasn't such a stretch to, you know, deal with HR issues. It wasn't such a stretch to market your practice. It was something that I already knew how to do and was familiar with. So it made that aspect, first of all, much easier, and second of all, much less expensive, because you don't have to pay somebody else to do it.
I know when I first met you and found out you were a dentist and hearing some of your stories, not knowing that you had a marketing background, one of the things that I was very impressed with, though, is I felt like you weren't just the same, like, boring dentist that's the stereotype, that you were out there doing interviews, doing podcasts, teaching, and I really feel like your marketing probably plays a big role in how diversified you are also.
It does. And I'm the type of person that, like, I get bored if I do the same thing 100% of the time all day long. I can't just do one thing. I'm more happy when I have, like, different projects going on. So for me, you know, teaching a class somewhere else or doing an interview or adding new things or adding new technology to my practice keeps me interested in my job and keeps me excited to go to work every day. But teaching opened a lot of doors for me. I was very fortunate to kind of fall into the situation where I teach a surgical course. Normally, and with COVID, it's kind of on hold right now, but normally I teach a surgical course once or twice a month in California, and I fly back from Colorado to California regularly. And it opened a lot of doors in that, you know, it was a whole other aspect of my career, meaning, you know, treating patients and that the fulfillment you get from that. But you can only treat one patient at a time. So, you know, I can, you know, fix 10 people a day. But when I teach other doctors how to fix their patients, I can teach 10 doctors how to fix 10 patients a day. And it's like an exponential amount of help going out into the world. So for me, teaching has become just as gratifying as actually seeing my own patients and helping them, because I feel like, well, if I can help, I can only help 10 people a day, but I could help 10 doctors and they can help 10 people a day. So it felt like a deeper level of help. And my mentor, who is the guy that I teach with, said that education is the key to immortality. Because even when you're gone, somebody who learns something from you will pass that on and teach somebody else how to do that. And that's that's really immortality, is education. And that was very meaningful to me.
So how did you get into teaching as well as practicing dentistry?
So I like I said, I worked in a Cherokee clinic for a little while right after school. That was my first job as a dentist. And I learned a lot because it was kind of an underserved population. It was in kind of the middle of Oklahoma, and there's not a lot of stuff around. And so I really learned a lot from that position and the doctors that I was working with, who were all much more experienced than I was. And then I moved to Colorado and worked for somebody for, it was like 6-8 months. It was less than a year. And the one big lesson I learned from that was I should never do that again. I learned I should never, ever work for another doctor, because it was not a great experience. And then I purchased my practice from a doctor who was retiring. And as I was growing and learning new things in my practice, I took a course in California, and I ended up doing really well with it. And the guy that taught the course and who was my teacher found out that I was doing really well with it and invited me to do a lecture and then invited me back. And then it just turned into me kind of really helping them, like, redesign how we teach this specific procedure. And it's been going really well. Like I said, I miss it. I can't wait for, now that all the COVID restrictions are starting to get a little less, and I'm just looking forward to doing it again. Cause as I've not done it for the past year, I've really missed it.
And I think the networking that can come with staying in touch with prior instructors, mm-hmm. professors, educators is often an untapped resource. I think many times people go to classes or they go to hear a speaker and then it ends there. So I think that's a valuable lesson, that you stayed in touch with an instructor and asked questions, and it blossomed and grew into this other opportunity for you.
It's true. And I think that maybe students or, you know, even, you know, professional students, you know, people who are professionals who are taking continuing education or learning something new are almost afraid of the people on the stage. Mm. And I don't know, maybe I'm just uncouth, but I'm not afraid of that. Like, I'm just like, well, I'll go ask them a question. The worst thing they're going to tell me is go away. So why not try? So when I had a question and talked to him about it and all this opened up, I took advantage of that. But I also try to pay that forward. You know, my students, we have a social media group for all the people that have graduated from the course that I teach, and we're very open, and I, you know, people send me stuff every day, and I, you know, email them back or call them back with advice, or, you know, tweak your technique a little bit here and maybe you'll see this result here. So I've tried to not, since I received that from somebody, I try to give that to students as well. And your
That's
students,
wonderful.
Yeah.
You share your knowledge.
And then your student, like, I've met some amazing people because people fly from all over the world to take that class. So now I have friends in Italy. I have friends in Mongolia and Chile and Australia and all these places that I'm like, man, I've got a couch to crash on no matter what country I go to, which is really great. So you meet a lot of interesting people, and then you can learn, like, well, how does this work in your country? So it's a really nice networking opportunity. And I try to really nurture all of those relationships because you learn so much from other people that you may have never met in any other situation.
I think another really good point is ask questions.
Oh, yeah.
Always ask questions. And I sometimes even have to give myself a little pep talk to say, is this person going to be annoyed that I asked them this question? And I always come back to, there's only two worst things that can happen. They can tell me no, or they can ignore me. And if those are the worst things, I can still keep going on. So when in doubt, always ask the question.
Yeah, ask the question. And don't be afraid of the no. Because, they said no. All right, you're no worse off than you were before you asked.
Agree.
They just said no,
Agree.
And at least you know. So.
So I wanted to ask you about, because I think it's applause to you for having your own practice, being in business for yourself. First off, when you're in dental school, is that always kind of the end goal for people? Or are there people that want the security of being in a partnership or being in a group with other dentists?
I think that's a really individual decision. And I think that feeling may change as you progress through your career. So when you're a younger, newer dentist, maybe you feel like you need that mentorship, you need that guidance from other people, although some people don't. Some people go out and throw up a shingle the first day they graduated and open up, and they all of them do pretty good. So I think that's probably an individual thing. For me, it was always kind of the goal, but that's kind of the environment that I saw from my dad's practice when I was a kid. My dad is a periodontist, a dental specialist, and he was always kind of a solo doc, did his own thing, was very, very well respected in his field and in our city. And that was my aspiration. And I always said, man, if I can be half as good as this as my dad is, then I'll be a success and that'll be good enough. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was always kind of the goal. And, you know, one of the only regrets I have is that I didn't do it soon enough. I feel like I probably could have skipped out on a lot of stressful situations if I had just said, I can do this and done it. Mm-hmm. Whereas I second-guessed myself and I was like, maybe I need to work for somebody else a little while longer. And then that went so poorly. I was like, nope, never again. And I kind of wish I hadn't put myself through that. But I did learn a lot of really good lessons about how I didn't want to run a business from that situation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So even, like I said, even though it was a stressful, difficult situation that I didn't enjoy, I feel like in hindsight, I learned a lot from that experience. So even when you make bad choices, as long as you learn a lesson, that's all you can do.
Just don't
make that same choice again. That's all.
So did you do that? Did you throw up a shingle and open your own place, or did you buy an existing practice?
So the way that I found my business was in dentistry, there are practice brokers, kind of like real estate agents, but they sell dental practices. And sometimes it associates real estate with that. You know, you're buying the building and the practice. Sometimes it's just the practice in somebody else's building. So I contacted some local practice brokers in my area, and there was a doctor who was getting ready to retire. And I went in and visited him. And when I first met him, he didn't want to sell. He just wanted a junior partner then to buy him out slowly. And I had just come out of, like I said, like a bad employment situation. And I was like, nope, not going to do it. So I walked away and made a deal to buy a different practice. There was another guy in town who got an offer to move out of state. And we got through the whole deal, and there was real estate involved and the business involved. And then literally like 2 days before we were supposed to close on the practice, he's like, my wife doesn't want to move to Montana or wherever it was. and he backed out of the deal. And I had spent, you know, thousands of dollars on lawyers and everything to go through. And so I was like, well, now what do I do? I don't have a business. But I did own his building already at that point, so I had a little bit of leverage. So I was like, well, you can pay me back all the money I spent on the lawyer trying to get this deal closed, or I can evict you from the building that I own now where your practice is. And he paid me back, and I sold him back his building, and that was that. But it was frustrating. And then the guy that I had originally talked to, the one I really wanted, was getting a little older and had hurt his shoulder. And he was like, I'm out. He's like, I got to retire. I got to get my shoulder reconstructed. I'm done. I just want to sell. And I was like, well, that's perfect. And I ended up with the place that I wanted, the first choice that I wanted anyway. Mm-hmm. So that couldn't have gone better. I'm kind of glad that other deal fell apart, because then I wouldn't be in the place that I am now.
It's like it was meant to be.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, you know, something aligned in the stars or whatever, and was like, no, you're supposed to be in this other joint. And that's where I am. And it worked out incredibly well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
So how large of a staff do you have?
I have 6 full-time employees. And it kind of prides me to say that I have 6 very, very highly intelligent female employees. Dentistry always has been kind of, you know, it's a male-driven practice. Not many dentists when I was a kid were women. Many of the people who worked in the office were women, but not a lot of dentists were women. So a lot of my patients had never had a female dentist in their whole life before I was their doctor. And a lot of them now are like, well, your hands are really small. I really like it. So they're like, when you're in the back, you hardly even know you're in there. But I'm really, really proud of the employees that I have. I've really tried, and it's a goal of mine to kind of cultivate an atmosphere of teamwork in my practice, where there's no situation and no person in my office that would ever say, that's not my job, and I won't do that, and myself included. Because if I won't do something, how can I ever expect somebody else to do it? Mm-hmm. So when somebody needs a hand, we help out. If somebody's, you know, nobody can answer the phone, I answer the phone. And patients think it's hilarious when I answer the phone. If I'm standing up in the front and both of my front office, you know, employees are busy and the phone rings, I pick it up. I may not always know the answer to the question, but I'll be like, oh, you got a question about your insurance? I'll be like, I'm sorry, this is Dr. Schnitzer. I am the worst person to ask this question to. Let me put you on hold for a sec, and then, you know, Virginia will get back with you. And the patients think it's hilarious, because they're like, why isn't doctor answering the phone? But because I'm there. So If I feel like leadership is a skill, and it's a skill I had to learn. Like, you don't just, I mean, there's some people who are natural born leaders, and there's some that, you know, you kind of have to acquire that. So to be a good leader, you have to set, you know, you have to have the vision, and you have to set expectations. And when the expectation is that we all are in this together, and, you know, we're all on the bus going in the same direction, and if one person isn't really, you know, if this isn't the destination that they want to go, that's fine. But they just have to get off the bus and find another one. It isn't going to work for us. Mm-hmm. So I've really managed to get the best possible team of people that I could ever ask for. And I feel very, very grateful for that. Mm-hmm. I get to go to work every day and work with some pretty amazing women. Mm-hmm. And it's really enjoyable when that happens. It's hard. It's an interesting situation where you have, like, 7 women in a building and, like, no drama. Like, there's none.
I was going to say, there's stereotypically, really none. You know, you might be like, oh, they're cat fights.
No, or never. Like, I left, you know, I was visiting you this weekend, and I left early on Thursday, and one of my employees got a new camper. She's got a couple of kids, and she's going to go camping with her kids. And the other 2 employees were going over to her house to check out the camper after work, because we were all getting out early. Mm-hmm. So I really think of I see my work family as much as I see my home family. Mm-hmm. They better be people that I like spending time with. Mm-hmm. And I do. And I think that's really, really reduced the stress level of working in medicine, because it's a stressful environment. Mm-hmm. Naturally. When you're in a stressful environment with people that you like to be around, it makes it a lot easier.
Well, it seems like at least you obviously lead by example by doing, not asking your staff to do anything that you yourself wouldn't do yourself. Are there other tips or pointers, or how do you think you've cultivated such a positive or teamwork environment in your office?
For me, I think that having extraordinarily clear, well-written out expectations is the key to reducing stress in any business. If employees know what they're supposed to do And if something changes, what they're supposed to do in that situation, I've just found that things work so much smoother. So having really good systems in your office to address everyday tasks and then tasks that don't happen every day. For example, if a new patient comes into my practice, we do the same thing every time. The routine is exactly the same. It's very efficient. I have patients say all the time, they're like, oh my gosh, you run on time, you're not late, which is hard at a dental office. You know, a lot of dentists run late all the time. But it's because we do the same thing every time. Every single person knows their role in that little dance that we do. And it's seamless every single time. And then we also have plans, like if something goes wrong, like, oh, you know, we're running a little late or somebody got an emergency. How do we fit that into the day? And we know how to do that. We know, you know, the people that work up front and do my schedule know, well, she's going to be in surgery right here, so she can't get an emergency here, but right here she should have time. Because we have systems in place and that have been established, and everybody knows exactly what role they're supposed to play. Mm-hmm. And we also back each other up. If somebody's running late, they need help cleaning up their room after, somebody goes and helps them. We don't leave them out there floundering on their own to run even later. Mm-hmm. So like I said, when it's really important to understand that even me, I'll go in and clean up the room. I don't care. I just want the next patient to be seen as on time as possible. Mm-hmm. So for me as a leader, part of it is checking the ego. I don't really have one at work. I don't care if I'm fixing a tooth or answering a phone or helping clean up a room or doing surgery or trying to put instruments in the sterilizer. These are things that need to get done every day. Ideally, everybody does those to the best of their ability, but sometimes you get busy and so I do it. Why shouldn't I? It's my business. There's nothing in that building that I shouldn't be able to do.
Mm-hmm. And I give you kudos for having what I generally call, you know, standard operating procedures or SOPs. Oftentimes when I initially meet with new clients, I ask them if they have SOPs. And unfortunately, a majority of businesses don't, which I think you're a prime example. Having SOPs, whether you're 2 people or 10 people or 100 people, makes all the difference in the world, because everyone knows the expectation and the process and the procedure. And as long as you can read and follow directions, there's really no excuse for not being able to at least attempt X, Y, or Z, whatever that may be.
Exactly. And it really, really reduces stress, because nobody's going, what do I do now? And wondering what they should be doing at any given time. It also really helps with productivity, because not only do you have SOPs for when you're really busy, but okay, what do we do if a patient cancels? Well, I'm not just going to sit around in my booty for an hour doing nothing. So we have a list of stuff that we do. And I don't, you know, if it's sharpening instruments, is it calling people that are overdue and getting them in, or is it washing a window? It doesn't matter what it is. But if you have those things already established, then as an employer, you don't have to worry about, well, my employees are sitting around texting all day. Well, I don't worry about that, because they've got 50 other things to do if the thing that they were supposed to do isn't happening. So it just doesn't, it's not something that I have to, I'm not a micromanager and I don't want to be. Mm-hmm. So I create an environment where I don't have to be, where mm-hmm. everybody knows what they're supposed to be doing.
Nice. So as an accountant, of course, I have to ask this, what financial procedures kind of do you have in place, and are you good with numbers, or have you just learned to be good with numbers?
So I was always good at math. Like, I took 3 semesters of calculus in college as an elective. So I was always kind of a math nerd, and, you know, marketing and business, I was always all right with that. So in medicine, and in dentistry especially, you know, there's insurance-driven financials, and then there's the patient version of the financials, because some of it comes from patients and some of it comes from insurance, and those are 2 very, very different things. The business part of my business took a while to get established, but now we have this, again, a standard operating procedure for financial agreements with patients. We provide an estimate of their benefits, and, you know, we're usually pretty close. There's about 8 gazillion insurance plans in the world, and we don't know all the ins and outs of every one of them, but we can get a pretty decent ballpark idea of what your insurance is going to cover, and we have a financial agreement for every patient, so they're aware of any charges before the day that they come in for their procedure, mm-hmm. and that's worked really well for us. We don't really have too many people that have financial surprises in our office. Some things will get you, like, you know, right now with the COVID stuff, there's supply chain issues and things like that. I was telling you yesterday, I used to pay $6 for a box of gloves, and now, you know, you might pay $60. So some of that is uncontrollable. It's not like we can't use gloves. We just have to deal with it. So some of that has changed, but I'm hoping, knock on wood, I'm hoping that as restrictions and things get back to normal, that some of that will decrease. Mm-hmm. But financially, I wish that dentists were given a more business education in school than just one class for one semester.
There's the administrative overhead part of accounting, paying your mortgage or your rent and your utilities and payroll and quarterly tax payments. I mean, there's that whole side of it. How's that been? Has it been a learn by fire kind of?
Some of it has been. Some of it I was sort of familiar with because, like, I had a job before dentistry. Some of it was like payroll. I had never done payroll before. So the first thing I did was, for years, I just did QuickBooks payroll and kind of did it all myself. And as I got busier, when I was slower and newer, that worked fine. And I'd only had maybe about 4 or 5 employees. As my business grew and I had more employees and then we started offering more benefits and things like that, it started getting much more complicated. And then I started making mistakes. And then I would have to call my accountant and be like, hey, I jacked up my payroll. Can you fix it for me? And finally, my accountant just had a come to Jesus talk with me and said, Deanna, you're a really, really good dentist. You're too busy to do payroll. Could you get somebody else to do that for you? Because you keep screwing it up because you don't have time to do it right. And I'm like, yeah, I could do that. And then I delegated that to a payroll company, and now I don't have to worry about it anymore. So
outsourced your weakness.
I did.
Tell everyone, focus on what you're good at and what makes you money and outsource the rest.
Yeah. And I'm the type of person where I'm like, I can do it myself. And then I was like, I just needed somebody to be like, you suck at this. And I'm like, oh, okay, I do. I really do. I email you twice a month that I screwed something up. It's probably going to be easier, and my time is more efficient looking at people's teeth than it is doing payroll. So a lot of that, I outsourced my weakness, and that helped. And man, it took a lot of stress off of me because then I didn't have to worry about the taxes being wrong or whatever, because I knew somebody else was responsible for
that. Someone that has the expertise in that.
But I'm also the kind of person where I need somebody smarter than me to tell me that. Like, I'm not going to come up with doing that on my own. I needed my accountant to be like, you suck at this. And I'd be like, all right, you know what you're talking about, and I don't. I'm going to trust you. And that's it. So I would have never done that on my own. But if somebody comes to me and be like, you make too many mistakes doing this, you need to do something else. And I'd be like, all right, I can do that.
What were you surprised to find was not that bad about running your own business?
The easiest thing about my job is the teeth. I would say, like, it really is. Like, the actual dental work is easy, and I enjoy every minute of it. And that's the easiest thing that I do all day. I tell people all the time, like, 10% of what I do all day, 10% of the effort that I use all day, the energy that I expend, is fixing teeth. 90% of the energy that I expend is creating relationships with people so that they trust me to do that 10% of fixing the problem. And I found that when you really spend the energy creating the relationship with the patient, or in any business relationship, the actual business becomes much, much easier. When your patients trust you, when they know that you have their best interest at heart, when your clients know you're not trying to rip them off or do things that don't need to be done or skirt the rules or skirt the, you know, biology, then the rest of it comes very naturally. I don't feel like I have to sell things to people. I just tell people what I see and what the options are to make it better, and then I let them pick one. Mm-hmm. And they know that I wouldn't recommend something if I didn't really think it was a thing that needed to happen. And they know that no matter what happens, I'm going to back it up and take care of them. But it's because I took the time and energy to establish that with people. And I think that goes across any business, whether it's medicine or any kind of service or product. If people believe in you, it's going to be much, much easier for them to participate in you from a business perspective.
And I think dentists, you know, there's still that stereotype. People are afraid of the dentist, hate the dentist, and people either seem to fall in one camp. They avoid the dentist at all costs because of fear or bad experiences, or there's other people that are like, I love my dentist. And so you're obviously trying to fall into that camp of building that rapport with your patients so they don't mind coming back every 6 months.
It's true. And some of my favorite patients are patients when I first met them and they were freaking out. I mean, they were, you know, we had to put them on Valium to get them in the chair. And then after a couple of visits, they don't need that anymore. And then as things progress, they're like, I don't even like to admit it, but I actually really enjoy coming now. And that's very rewarding for me That's not only something that will benefit them and their health for the rest of their life, but then, you know, their kids are going to be less nervous, because when a kid sees mom nervous to go to something, they're going to be nervous. So when mom's like, come on, let's go to the dentist, it's kind of fun, you know, it makes for an entirely different experience for a kid. So that is really important to me. And like I said, some of my favorite patients are the ones that, when they walked in, they were like, I hate the dentist. And now they're like, all right, I like it. It's not so bad. And usually it's not so bad is one of the best compliments you can get. So as a dentist, you're like, oh, well, it didn't suck as much as I thought it would, which is not too bad for a dental office.
I can agree completely. As an accountant, I have people that are petrified of numbers, terrible, embarrassed. And after I've worked with them for a while, not only are they like, okay, I actually understand. They're like, I think I actually want to look at my profit and loss because I understand it, and maybe I can make smart decisions for my future. So yeah, it makes you feel very good to help people get across that fear.
It is. And it's really, I think it's really important, you know, from that perspective. I don't think you can be really good at something if you don't kind of understand how it works. You know, like, I don't know anything about cars. I couldn't change a tire on my car to save my life. But it's because I don't know how a tire works. You know, I don't know how it attaches or whatever. And maybe if I did, I wouldn't be so terrified of trying to change a tire. And I might even be good at changing a tire, but I'm certainly not going to be good at it now. And I find it interesting that people feel that they can be really good at owning a business and not know how it works. Mm. Like, not understand, you know, what their overhead is. Like, if you ask an average business owner what their overhead percentage is, would they be able to tell you an answer? Mm-hmm. And how do you know if you're doing well? Or how do you know if you need to work or improve on an area? How do you know if you need to grow another area? How do you know if you need to shrink an area? Mm-hmm. How do you know if you have the potential to grow if you don't really know what you're doing? Mm-hmm. So just like, you know, a mechanic needs to know how a car works, I think a business owner needs to know how their business works from a numbers perspective. If you don't know that, then you're probably just going to be stuck. You're never going to grow, or you're never going to really change, and you might not be as profitable as you could be.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really good point. And maybe that's something I'll do a little future mini podcast on is, you know, you bring in this money, it's your sales, it's your income. And then how much money, for every dollar you bring in, how much goes out for your cost of goods sold or your cost of service, your cost of labor? That's a percentage. And based upon your industry, there are industry standards that say, hey, you're doing a good job or you need improvement. And then even the bottom line is, for every dollar you bring in, how much is truly income in your pocket once you've paid everything? And people are always surprised when they look at those percentages. I love doing that. I did that with just a restaurant yesterday as to how much is for every dollar you bring in is going out for marketing, is going out for food, is going out for labor. It's very telling, and you can see on your area's improvement. And also, does it agree with your priorities? Are you prioritizing your staff? Are you prioritizing the quality of your products? Or are you prioritizing something you didn't even realize?
So one thing that I talk about when I lecture, when I teach, is how different insurance plans can affect your profit. And I'm not talking about your collections. That's, you know, gross. I'm talking about what you bring home. Mm-hmm. So there's some insurance plans out there that are pretty bad. I mean, they pay you, you know, 50% of what would be normal, usual, customary, and reasonable for a procedure. So what I say is, okay, you've just agreed to accept 50% less money, but your bills haven't changed. You still have to keep the lights on. You still have to pay your assistant. You still have to pay the dental laboratory their fee to get the product. But you brought home no money. And in some cases, you are actually losing money doing that work. Now, everybody else is getting paid. Your receptionist is getting paid. Your assistant is getting paid. Your lab is getting paid. The electric company is getting paid. But you didn't feed your family doing that work. So how is that really benefiting you? So when you're deciding on which of these contracts with insurance companies you want to sign, think about that. When you take a 30% reduction in income, you are not necessarily taking a 30% reduction in cost or overhead. Your overhead stays the same. So all you did was take a 50% reduction in profit. Mm-hmm. And when you're the business owner and you have a family to feed, that's what you need. You have to have profit. If you're running a non-profitable mm-hmm. business, that's great. If you're a charity, but you're not, mm-hmm. you have to feed your family too. So if everybody else in your life is getting paid and you're not, why are you doing this? Maybe you should do something different, because you have to be able to make a living and pay your mortgage and feed mm-hmm. your kid. Mm-hmm. So
how about all the different business regulations that affect your field?
I mean, the regulations in medicine are infinitesimal. I mean, there are government agencies assigned to every aspect of working in medicine on a federal level, on a state level, on a local level. And the COVID pandemic has made that even more clear. People actually see now, like, how these regulations in health work. Doctors already knew that. Now the general public is like, oh, that's how that works. And we're like, yeah, that's how much regulation we've always had to go through. So for me, some of that was expected in medicine. There's just a lot of paperwork. There just is. But there's always more. Like every year, it seems like there's something else that they've come up with. And COVID has made that even more obvious, because now there's three times as much as there ever was 2 years ago.
And how has COVID, like, I feel like it's kept you even busier than ever. What, you've been pretty at the forefront and a leader, especially in Colorado, in COVID and how it affects your field.
So when the COVID shutdown happened, all elective, well, I'm going to put that in big quotation marks, elective healthcare was shut down. And I had a big moral and ethical problem with that, because I don't think healthcare is elective. Like, I don't think somebody who's having knee pain or, you know, migraine headaches or a toothache, I don't consider any of that elective. Like, that's medicine and that's healthcare, and that should be something that people can obtain when they need it. So I didn't like my profession being called elective, because, like, decay is a disease, periodontal disease is a disease. Many of these things get worse when people get stressed. I've never seen as many cracked teeth in my career as I've seen in the last 18 months, because everybody's freaking out and grinding through their teeth and their dental work. Mm-hmm. So Colorado was actually the first state in the nation to open up for elective healthcare, which means we were the first ones to go back.
And dental was considered
elective. Which I didn't agree with. But, you know, that's probably a political issue, not really a medical issue. So when Colorado was ready to go back, I was like, well, you know, there's this disease. And this was in April of 2020. Mm-hmm. We didn't know as much about it then as we did now. We had mm-hmm. really no idea what we were getting into, because everything shut down in March. And then we kind of went back up in April, the end of April. And I was like, well, I got to go back to work. What do I do? Because I work in an environment where normally we're kind of covered in spit and blood all day. And, you know, mm-hmm. during a respiratory virus pandemic, that could be a problem. So I actually, me and Matt took a trip to Arizona and just stayed outside. We stayed in an Airbnb, just us, and everything was shut down. We just got a lot of takeout and went to the pool, because I'm like, I got to get out of town to think about this. So I sat in the pool and did a bunch of research. And, you know, we have some immunology, and I understand, you know, respiratory viruses. And at that time, you know, I'm thinking about other respiratory viruses that we deal with, tuberculosis and things like that, that we have to deal with in dentistry, you know, normally. Mm-hmm. And, okay, what kind of precautions do we take? So I just did a ton of research and read a bunch of OSHA stuff and wrote up a document, basically best practices for dental offices for how to mitigate risk during this pandemic, when it came to social distancing, when it came to, you know, PPE that we needed to buy to protect ourselves and our patients, when it came to how are we going to, you know, disinfect things. And I really wrote a pretty well-written document. And then I sent it to my dad, who's a dentist or a periodontist in St. Louis. And he was like, this is really good. Can I share this with some people? And I was like, because they were getting ready to go back too. And the American Dental Association hadn't put anything out yet, because we were going back before they did anything. Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, you can send it to people. And then I kind of shared it with some colleagues in town, and they were like, well, this is really good. And so I ended up submitting it to the local dental association, and they kind of put their stamp on it. And then I submitted it to the Colorado Department of Public Health, and they put their stamp on it. So I kind of wrote the regulations that everybody was kind of using to start out with. And then the ADA came out with some stuff and that helped. But for the early adopters that went back, it was, I mean, I had a lot of people tell me it was really helpful. And another thing that I did was I was like, man, we just need a place for like all of us in Colorado to talk about this stuff. Like, what are you doing at your office? And do you guys have any gloves? Because we're running out because you can't get gloves anymore. And so I created a group on social media for Colorado dentists. And now we have like 1,000 members. And it's all just dentists in Colorado helping each other, figuring out, like, you know, we were putting together PPE orders as bulk orders and helping each other through this. Whereas normally you would think, well, the dentist down the street is your competition. I don't really feel that way. I don't think the other dentists are my competition. I feel like somebody going on a cruise is my competition. Like, are they going to spend money on their dental work or are they going to go spend money on a cruise? That's my competition. So I have to establish the value of the dental work because that's probably not what they want to spend money on. So I always thought of colleagues as colleagues, and we should all be helping each other because we all have the same goal, which is treat our patients and make them healthy and get the job done, especially in that kind of emergency situation. So I started a group with another friend of mine, and it grew, and it was really helpful. And to this day, it's really helpful. I'm in there all the time, and we're just talking to each other and, you know, oh, I need a part for this and it's not going to come in time. Does anybody have one I can borrow? And, you know, it's a really, really positive, helpful environment. And that made me really, really happy because I think it helps dentists not see each other as competition. We should all be seeing each other as colleagues because really we're not competition. There's enough teeth in this world to fix. There really are.
I admire, too, that you don't sit back and wait for someone else to give you direction. You not only think about what you need for yourself and your practice, but then share it with others and say, if you find this helpful, great, use it. And that's just nice that you're not waiting for someone else to tell you what you need to do.
Yeah. And I mean, at some points we were kind of waiting around for the government to tell us what to do, but they didn't really give us much instruction other than, all right, have at it. And I was like, well, somebody's got to figure this out. And I was like, well, somebody, I'm like, I don't know. I don't think I'm that smart, but I'm like, somebody's got to do this. So I'm like, well, I'll do it. And I just wrote it. And then, like I said, well, somebody needs to get all the dentists together so that we can help each other out. And I'm like, oh, we'll start a Facebook group. And that's that. So it didn't take a lot of effort. I mean, the document took some effort because that took a lot of research, but you know, that's like medical research. But starting a Facebook group is easy. You want to start a Facebook group for any kind of, or a social media group of any kind for any kind of profession. No matter what you do, there are people that are going to want to talk to you about what you do and how you do it different than, you know, the other guy down the block or the other guy on the other side of the world or wherever it is. And you can learn so much from other people. You can learn much more from other people than you can from a book sometimes in these kind of situations. And I learn something new from my colleagues every day. And I think it's amazing. I just think there are a lot of things about social media that are not good, I think, you know, for society, like, and there's movies about that now, but this is one aspect of that social media where you can really network with other people and it's a really beneficial thing professionally. And it can go bad. You know, there's groups that you probably don't want to be a part of, but there are some that are really, really helpful and educational. And I think that's a way to take that media and make it work for you in your business and in your professional life.
So what's next for you? What do you see the next 5 years or 10 years for you as a dentist and a business owner?
I'm not sure really. I'm at the point in my career now where I'm kind of like, I wouldn't mind taking a little bit more time off, going on more vacations, but I've kind of put in the legwork for that. You know, you pay your dues for 10 years and then you're like, okay, now I can take some afternoons off and go to wherever.
Any wild goals or dreams?
I'd like to have,
we're putting it out there into the universe, maybe.
So I'd like to have we're fully digital in that we don't have paper charts. We don't have, you know, nobody has paper forms or anything like that, but there's a lot in dentistry that's still mechanical. So I'm trying to move my office into a more digital phase. So for example, I just bought some new equipment. talking about new, not, we're going to talk about the tech part of the numbers in tech now. So some new equipment where you can scan things digitally and not have to use, you know, impression materials and things that, you know, impression materials work fine. And there's some cases where that's what you have to do, but it takes out a lot of error if you can do things digitally. So scanning things, 3D printing, these kind of things, this kind of newer technology that's coming out is now so easily available that you can, it's affordable for your average dental practice. Whereas maybe before it was only a giant dental lab that could afford a milling machine. Now they have milling machines that your average dentist can have in their office and do some stuff on their own. So those kinds of digitizing things and
I love the idea of not having to do those.
The squishy impressions.
Oh, those impressions, the grainy flavor of them. And just to have a digital scan.
Yeah.
That's like futuristic, wonderful.
It's really, really nice. And it's very efficient for patients too. So let's say you make a kid a retainer, right? And you scan their teeth after their braces and you make them a retainer. And kids lose their retainers like twice a year. This is what happens. Mm-hmm. It would be really nice if you just had that scan saved in your computer and you could just send it to the lab and have them make a new retainer and then call the kid and say, hey, come pick up your new retainer. And they don't have to come in and get the goopy stuff in their mouth again. It saves the mom time because she doesn't have to bring the kid for an extra visit. It saves you time in the office because you don't have to use more materials to make the kid a new retainer. Mm-hmm. You can just, oh, I got that file from last year. We'll send it back to the lab, tell them to reprint it or whatever, and that's it. So it not only is good for me as the business owner, but it's really nice for the patient because they don't have to make an extra trip. So as technology evolves, so must your business.
And the cost of technology is coming down.
Exactly. And I'm not saying that these things are inexpensive.
Right.
I mean, the scanners, you know, we're talking a $25,000 piece of equipment, but they used to be a $50,000 piece of equipment or a $100,000 piece of equipment. So it's getting to the point where it's not unreachable for somebody to finance that. You know, you pay it off over a couple of years and you're good. Mm-hmm. So whereas, you know, 10 years ago, this might have cost as much as a house. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't an option for most people.
So it increases your productivity. You can offer more services. I also think, too, it's an important lesson. You exemplify reinvesting in education for yourself and also investing in your practice and in equipment, machinery, whatever that may be. A lot of business owners, I think, they open it, whatever this business is, and then that's it. And really, to be successful, you need to keep reinvesting in yourself and your business.
You do. And I always say, I would rather put this into my business than pay it in taxes. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I would much rather buy a piece of equipment that I really, really want and have that to use. Mm-hmm.
Those are important conversations to have. And I typically have them a lot of times around like the fourth quarter of every year. We look at a profit and loss and we're like, hey, it's been a great year, whether you've done good in sales or controlled your expenses. And I often say, is there any equipment you need? Or are you going to give staff raises or things of that nature? There can be tax benefits to reinvesting back in your business rather than just paying it out in extra taxes.
Exactly. I'm like, where would you rather put the dollar? I would rather put the dollar in my pocket, in my team's pocket, or into my business where then it's going to be my pocket, my team's pocket for a long time. So I would much rather do that than, you know, I mean, the government needs to run, but I give them plenty. I don't need to give them any extra this year or any year. So I really believe that things like marketing are an investment in your practice. You're growing your business with that, and it's a great tax write-off. My accountant loves that I do a lot of marketing every year. She's like, your marketing budget's amazing, like every year. And so there's in dentistry, there's two kind of schools of thought about marketing. One is that you don't need it, and one is that you do. And a lot of dentists, I think, feel that signing up with insurance companies is a good marketing technique because it will bring in patients. And I'm like, that's not really marketing. Insurance companies limit how much you can charge for the work that you do. So let's say that you were a restaurant and you signed up with an insurance company that's going to help people pay for their steak. That insurance company tells you, this is what you can charge for that steak and no more. That's it. It doesn't take into account the quality of steak you use. It doesn't take into account what you have to give to the farmer. It doesn't take into account what you have to give to the guy to cook the steak. It's just, this is what we say you can charge for the steak. That's challenging. Now, you may get a lot of people who want that cheap steak, but are you really making any money making that steak? Or is it the kind of steak that you want people to be eating? You know, you're going to have to cut a corner somewhere so that you can feed your family. Maybe you buy a lower quality meat. Maybe you pack your restaurant full of people so that you sell more steaks to make up for the fact that you're not getting as much. Exactly. So it's not as nice of a restaurant. So that's not marketing. That's really lowering your income and then trying to compensate for it. Marketing is attracting people, telling them what you offer so that they think it's a great steak to buy.
You gave a really interesting marketing tip that I had never even thought about, that I said, you have to share this. I asked, do you do radio ads as marketing?
Yeah, I do talk radio every morning. I'm on the radio every morning in Colorado during morning drive. And talk radio is different than, you know, this is from my advertising background. Talk radio is different than regular radio. Because people who listen to talk radio don't turn it off during the commercials. Why would they?
Because I do that. Yeah. If I don't... I listen to the songs I want to hear and then commercials come on and I turn it off and then I check back later.
Statistically, market research shows that people who listen to talk radio, they're just hearing a voice. They don't differentiate between the voice of the radio announcer or the voice of the advertisement. So talk radio is a really, really good option. And I'm very, very fortunate in Colorado. We have like an 80,000 watt station that's talk radio and they do the Broncos and they do the Rockies. And I'm on that station every morning during morning drive. And it goes all the way out to, like, I have patients who come from South Dakota because they can pick up that station from Colorado where they live. And they'll be like, I'm like, well, you're from Wyoming. And they're like, well, I heard you on the radio. So social media is great. It has a really far reach. But there are other forms of media that are affordable for your average small business owner that are actually really, really effective. Mm-hmm. We had to limit how many new patient consults we did per day. And to be perfectly honest, I'm booked out for new patient consults for a while. I mean, like July. So, and you know, 2 months in advance.
I'm always surprised at how effective radio advertising is.
It is. And if you do it right, it's effective. And there's studies and, you know, it took me a 4-year college degree to learn all this stuff, but there's studies on how many times a person needs to hear a message before it sinks in. How many seconds of that message will they actually absorb and things like that. So there are books that talk about this and there are marketing companies that know this for you. You know, if it's not a strong point for you, maybe delegate that weakness and have a marketing, a reputable marketing company do this with you. But there are ways to get your message to people that you may not think about. And you also have to kind of think about who are the people that you want to reach. You want to reach people that would be interested in what you have to offer. You know, dentistry is kind of easy because everybody got teeth pretty much, you know, or they wish they did. So that's a big target market. So who do you want to talk to? If you are a nail salon, you may more target women than men. So what are the things that are women listening to on the radio and demographically or on TV or whatever, demographically, you can find that research and do it. And there are people called media buyers that do that for a living. And I, like I said, I worked with them a lot and I was one for a while. So you can really figure out who are you trying to target with your message and then where are they? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if your target market is children, you know, you sell children's toys or, you know, you work for Nickelodeon, you probably don't want to be on like nighttime TV because the kids aren't watching that. They're sleeping. So you really need to make sure that you know who you're trying to reach and what you're trying to say and be very, very clear about that. You know, one message at a time, repeatedly, and people get it and it works. If advertising didn't work, Super Bowl ads would be cheap and they're not because they work.
Very good advice. Yeah. Well, as we start to wrap this up, I always end each interview with the Proust questionnaire. So it's 10 simple questions. Well, maybe not simple. They're supposed to be thought-provoking. But 10 questions, and I just want quick answers. We'll try not to discuss. Question 1, what is your idea of perfect happiness?
I have two answers for that. My first answer is security, meaning you don't have anything to worry about. My second answer is if you could eat all the ice cream you want and not get fat, that would be perfect happiness.
Yum.
Yeah.
When and where were you the happiest?
Probably on vacation, but there's times at work where I'm very, very happy too. And in medicine, you get to do a lot of very rewarding things for people, and it can be very life-changing. So some of my most downtrodden patients have actually made me the most happy professionally. And then personally, you know, it's nice to take a break.
Which living person do you admire the most?
Probably my dad. He's been my mentor in many, many ways, not only professionally and personally. And so I always said if I could be half as successful as my dad, I'd consider myself a success. So
what is your latest extravagance?
Oh, I bought a watch. I never owned a grown-up watch before. I brought a real grown-up watch. It's really pretty. Beautiful. You can't see it on a podcast, but trust me, it's pretty.
It makes you happy.
Yeah.
What talent would you most like to have?
I wish I was more like naturally athletic. Like my partner that I live with, he seems like he's really athletic at everything. Like he runs marathons and he can like do all these things, and sometimes I like trip going down the stairs. So I just would love to be like naturally athletic and graceful.
What do you consider your greatest achievement?
My greatest achievement at work is building, well, I guess I would say professionally. My greatest achievement professionally is building a business that I feel like I have the luxury of doing what I want. So I've put in the effort, I've put in the time to be able to explore things that I want to do. I don't just do what I have to do. I can go outside of that. Personally, I think my greatest achievement is finding a situation where you feel secure, where you're not worried, about having a roof over your head and things like that. So I think there's definitely both aspects of that to life. And if one is out of whack, the other is going to be out of whack.
So then what is your greatest regret?
My greatest regret is that I didn't try to go out on my own sooner. I went through some bad employment situations that were very, very, very stressful. And even though I learned from that, I wish I had just been brave enough to be like, no, I can do this and go right on my own. So I lost time there, and that's kind of the one thing you can't get back.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Rock star. I would totally be a rock star. Like musician up on stage. I've been in bands and sang in bands and I love it. And so if that was reliable work, I would totally do that.
You should be the singing dentist.
I am at the office sometimes. Yeah. I don't even charge extra for the concert. No.
What profession would you not like to do?
I think if I was a preschool teacher, I would probably be miserable. Because I have a lot of respect for people who can be around large numbers of very small people all day long. I think that must be the hardest job in the whole wide world. I could never do it. I love my little patients, but I only have to see them for like an hour. That's good.
And what is your motto?
Don't knock it till you tried it. Try everything once. You don't have to try it twice, but you should try it once.
Well, thank you very much for joining on the podcast. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Numbers and Tech Podcast. Future episodes will include chats with other amazing entrepreneurs. Let's keep the conversations going, whether you are running the show or working on your side hustle. We give you the business advice you need. If you learned something new or felt inspired, let me know. If you want more tips and great information, follow my Instagram account, Numbers and Tech, or email info@numbersandtech.com. Always remember to grab life by the bottom line.